Welcome to the TCM Challenge, a monthly movie review podcast where Matt and I challenge each other to watch some classic films. And this month's movie is 1977's Annie Hall. And I'm Matt in Buffalo.
And this is Matt in Arizona.
Well, Matt, I think this is probably the most well-received, recognized, appreciated film that we've done.
I can't remember.
Biggest Oscar one.
Is this the first Best Picture winner we've done? I think it might be.
At first blush, I think it is, because we always look at that stuff, and it probably is, but it's also obviously the most widely acclaimed one. Before we get too deep into that, let's revisit how we got here, though. So you had several films to pick from. You picked an interesting one, but you had a lot of great ones. So going very briefly through it, 1981's Pennies from Heaven. Turns out we had two Christopher Walken films this month to select from. That's also a Steve Martin film. Bad Little Angel from 1939. Annie Hall from 1977. The Great Race from 1965. And then Throne of Blood from 1957. We touched on it last time, but Matt, why did you settle on Annie Hall?
It's, again, one of those movies that I hadn't seen, but obviously heard of and wanted to see it. Despite the Woody Allen connection,
we'll get to that.
Yeah. This movie doesn't do a whole lot to dissuade me from reminding it, but I didn't hold it against the movie. And I also really like Diane Keaton. And I must say, I mean, I'm more familiar with her you know, newer work where she's an older woman and she's still gorgeous. But I mean, young Diane Keaton is really beautiful in this, I think.
Oh, she's a standout. We'll get to that, but yeah. Okay. So always do the, baselining where we're at. So the top box office from 1977, you know, the dawn.
Yeah. I wonder what it is.
Yeah. Star Wars is just blows everyone out of the water. Smokey and the Bandit, Close Encounters of the Third
Great
Kind,
film.
Saturday. Yeah. There's some bangers in here.
I mean, 77's a good year.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're in the heart of, you know, the second golden age of Hollywood 70s films. Just really interesting stuff across the board. Plus, like, it starts to get modern with Star Wars, Close Encounters, right? Then there's throwbacks, and it's just daring. It's an awesome time, right? And tons of stuff that just still isn't in the modern consciousness. There's so many hidden gems, by the way, through there. But continuing on, Saturday Night Fever, A Bridge Too Far, The Deep, The Spy Who Loved Me, Oh God, which is the George Burns. Yeah. And then rounding out the top 10 was Annie Hall. And then the big thing where this movie was really the standout, it was nominated for the Big Five Awards. So Best Picture, Best Director, Actor, Actress, and then Writing.
Screenplay.
Yeah, and it got four of them, right? Including Best Picture, Best Directing by Woody Allen, Best Actress with Diane Keaton, and then Best Screenplay, Original Screenplay, or whatever it was back then, for Woody Allen, right? So this was his only Best Picture winner, and probably his most well-regarded, remembered film.
Yeah.
Beyond that, how much other exposure have you had to Woody Allen? Were you familiar with his more zany stuff that came before?
I mean, I haven't seen a whole lot of his films, but yes, I'm familiar with his filmography. Like, I think he tended, like you said, he tended to be a little bit more zany early on, and he went kind of off kilter art house in his later years.
And this is like a real transitional film for him, because it still has a lot of that, like, insane, I don't know, satirical, just, you know, very odd, surreal stuff. But it still has a streak of seriousness.
Yeah. And you know what? We'll get into it as we talk about it. But I think this film's best quality is that for all the zaniness and kind of heightened reality that there is, there's also a realness to it that I found really charming.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think we probably should just forego the traditional way that we've walked through movies, you know, with the plot, because this has no real plot per se. and it's very unconventionally structured and, you know, intentionally so. So there's no necessarily linear path that we can go through it other than kind of talking about the characters throughout. So kind of just jumping all over the place.
There is one thing we should do, though. We should, some of them have bigger parts than others, but we should play spot the future movie star as we go through this plot.
All over the place. Yeah. Did you pick up Your Girl at the end?
Oh, yeah.
Blink and you miss it? Okay.
I knew about her. We'll get to it.
Right. And also, you know, to address the elephant in the room, we've always talked about this stuff, and it's good to get out of the way. Man, watching, you know, older films, it's fraught with stuff. And I will say, watching a Woody Allen movie, it's like watching a horror movie through your fingers, you know, just afraid of what you'll see. It's just like, can we white knuckle it through this without there being some uncomfortable underage stuff? So there is the scene where it's flashback to his childhood with the young children, which, okay, it's kind of funny.
It's funny, but it's not helped by the fact that at one point they put Woody Allen in the actual scene with the kids.
Yeah. And a 6-year-old girl saying, "I like leather."
I did laugh at that. I did.
I know. So, okay. So that's funny. But then, like, what, with 10 minutes left in the film, his best friend is pissed when Woody Allen has to get about bailed out.
Interrupting him with 2 16-year-olds, yeah.
Yep. I was just like, oh, damn, so close to getting it to the wire.
Okay, but at least that was his friend and not him.
Well, that's the thing. It's when if you watch that documentary series that came out about him, I never put it together, and I think they're right, how often it comes up more than by chance in his written movies that there's an apparent need to try and legitimize
underage romance.
Yes. So it's like, yeah, but if Woody Allen's voice wasn't over every single inch of this film, I would hear that. But, you know, it's in this too, and I think people kind of forget it.
But full disclosure, I was able to set that knowledge aside and just watch the film for what it was.
So this is the thing. I try to be good with that. I had a little bit of a harder time this time. Ultimately, I did. And I think we can move on immediately here. But one of my notes that I wrote is, man, it's a shame because immediately he has such an interesting presence on the screen and his character. It starts out with his almost intrusive, almost kind of uncomfortable, him talking straight to the audience and doing the old, vaudevillian type jokes and stuff. But I just sat there and thinking, like, man, peak Woody Allen, with everybody being naive, what he apparently turned out to be. Wow, he's really interesting and funny.
Yeah. Right.
So, I don't know. Where do we want to jump in? There's a whole bunch of ground to cover. It's just, I don't know where to approach it.
We kind of jump in into the middle of their relationship, because I think the first scene we see with him and Diane Keaton is them going to the movies or trying to go to the movies, and they're late for one, and he's anal about, being at the start of a film.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's one of them. It's the, there's a whole bunch of themes, I'll say, or, you know, motifs that show up in it. That's kind of the introduction of the whole intellectualism or the pseudo intellectualism throughout all this, how much people value, I guess, all that, and how all the phoniness and posturing was there too. But he's equally guilty of all of it. There's so much hypocrisy all through this of his character, everyone's and stuff. So, yeah, that's kind of the first one. And then one of the parts that I thought, because that's kind of a launching point into Diane Keaton's character, is he always, without saying as much, was always looking down on her intelligence.
Oh, yes.
And was thinking she's pseudo-intellectual. And it's not like he's all that much greater or anything.
No, but I mean, we'll get into it. But when I mean, Diane Keaton in this Annie Hall is never not smart. She's just a little naive because she's this Midwestern girl who's just come to New York, and so he kind of looks down upon that as seeing, you know, that she's just like this bumpkin.
It's almost like she has an original sin because she's not from New York City to him, and is always going to kind of look down on
her. That's another motif, is that anything not New York is just anathema to Woody Allen's character, especially Los Angeles.
Oh yeah. I mean, this is, well, the background is it's essentially just him. I think, but yeah, no, this is just straight out Woody Allen's kind of mentality, it feels like, throughout the whole thing. Oh boy. I mean, where do we even jump around to? By the way, the house that's under the roller coaster, totally real.
Oh, is that real?
Yes, it's absolutely real. It was a hotel, originally made to be a hotel, with the roller coaster being an attraction for it. Mm-hmm. And then it turned into a personal house. You can find it on like the New York Post or something. Somebody interviewed a woman who used to live there or summer there. And she's like, oh yeah, no, you would just rattle the house. You would fall asleep to it rattling. And her aunt and uncle would talk about like, oh, there's going to be a lot. It's July. There's going to be a lot of coasters going, and the house would just like shake around. So, oh yeah, no, that's insanely, absolutely real. You would think the goofiest thing in the movie. No, that's the actual real part.
No, I mean, this movie, I'm trying to think of movies that kind of go meta. And one of the motifs in this movie is there's some fourth wall breaking, but it's kind of weird because I almost called it in my notes, it's like third and a half wall breaking, because sometimes there's these asides that they're not directed toward the audience, but they're outside of the scene that's playing. So, for example, when they're in line for this movie, this Holocaust document, or what is it, Nazi World War II documentary that he's seen like multiple times.
Is that what there's like a few movies? It's like, I don't know, a Bergman film or something like that.
Anyways, they're in this line. He's getting real pissed off because the guy in back of him is just criticizing this one director, and apparently like is just getting all the nuances wrong. And so there's an aside where he has this confrontation with this guy, and he pulls out the actual director to have this conversation with.
That one and the other couple good ones are where he is talking to Annie Hall, breaks and turns and just starts addressing different characters walking on the street.
We're just and down it's not the street. Third person, so like,
or fourth wall.
And it's like I said, it's not fourth wall breaking, but it's meta. So like I said in my notes, it's third and a half wall breaking.
Mm-hmm. Which, by the way, with that one, it's hilarious because the camera turns and you just look up the street and there's just a ton of people watching them film the scene, and they just left that there. Just a big crowd on the corner just watching Woody Allen.
I'm sure. How could there not be?
No. So, oh boy. I mean, the other thing, kind of the Midwestern thing, is also the Jewish identity for him throughout this, because that's a huge story. And I love the, you know, you're a real Jew, or you're what my mother would call, or my grandmother would call
Grammy Jew. Hall would call a real Jew.
Yeah. Cause all you do is make money, or all you do is try and make money. And I just love that when you end up going to their house and they juxtapose, and it's not, they don't hit you over the head with it necessarily, but Annie Hall's family is the most waspish people out there. With just mansion practically.
I mean, just white bread. With Colleen Dewhurst as her mother, who was an actress I really like in several different
things. Oh yeah, that I missed. I didn't catch that kind of stuff, but actors all over, but they're the ones that have this crazy money and income and everything like that, and then they juxtapose immediately to seeing Alan's family, and they're living under a roller coaster, and they're, you know, they have no money, but they're letting somebody else steal it from him and that kind of stuff.
And again, I like this creativity of they're having dinner in two different places, but there's a point in the scene where they splice together the two families and it looks like they're talking with each other, even though they're in two different rooms.
Oh yeah. I mean, the movie is just like creative and changing like all over the place.
And I thought it was also, it also made me laugh too, going back to the Jewish motif of when he's sitting there with her family, he's picturing in her head that they're picturing just him as this like stereotypical Hasidic Jew.
Oh, that's like was the most laugh out loud part of it, is just the absurdity. It's right up there with Planes, Trains, and Automobiles to me, of turning and seeing John Candy as just like the devil. It's like just the insane. And that's like the only occurrence in that movie, which makes that one even more insane. But it's, oh man, where do we even go? Because this is just non-linear film.
We establish who Woody Allen is as a character. His name is Alvy. And we learned that he's been married twice before, his first wife being Star Trek's Carol Kane now. That was surprising. I didn't know she was in this. Mm-hmm. And I forget.
Adorable, by the way. Young Carol Kane is just.
I've always liked her. Always liked her.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Star Trek. And then his second wife was, I guess, was like a doctor or something. She was someone who hung around with a bunch of like professors and snobby people.
Right. So what we end up seeing is what the joke at the beginning is. I wouldn't want to be a part of any club where I was a member.
Right.
Right. So what you end up seeing is his character is, I don't know, self-loathing, maybe not really.
Self-loathing, self-sabotaging.
Self-sabotaging, maybe not self-loathing, because he has like, you know, one of the best jokes in there is, you know, don't bash masturbation, it's sex with somebody I love.
I love
right?
That line made me laugh out loud. I loved it. I was like, I'm going to keep that and use that in my life.
Yeah. So it's like, I don't know. He's like, he has a really high opinion of himself, but he won't let himself have any joy. Right. So,
right.
And that's internally self-conflicting, just always having like two diametrically opposed kind of thoughts at the same time. That's the whole thing for him at this whole thing. So he does love himself. He thinks he's brilliant. However, he will make sure he sabotages every relationship he's ever in. Can't have any joy from any single thing ever. Completely neurotic, absolutely all the time, right?
I mean, even when he has someone like Carol Kane who's basically throwing herself at him.
Mm-hmm. That's like, I get that he's famous in this world, this character, Alvy Singer, right, is the character. You know, writer, comedian, it's Stephen King writing himself into everything. This is basically Woody Allen.
Basically, and he's been on TV a few times. He's basically a known comedian in the New York circuit.
That said, it's also like really that many people are throwing themselves at little nebbish Woody Allen, who weighs, 110 pounds soaking wet in this thing. Mm. I have write your own, you know, thing here, but it's like George Costanza in Seinfeld, that many chicks too. But
IRL, before he went all creepy, the man was able to score Mia Farrow.
Well, to be real, it is Woody Allen, so yes, I suppose so. but that's his whole character throughout this, and I do think the main crux of the movie is maybe a little cynical for me. Like, I kind of get it because it's him projecting that onto what all relationships are, that they're all going to fail and they're all kind of transitory. And it's not definable. Like, it's like these are horrible. They're chaotic. They're always doomed to kind of fall apart, but we still want to chase after those. It's fine for a movie to say that. I don't believe it. I think it's a little bit overly cynical, and it's informed by his kind of neuroses here of not allowing himself to be happy.
Well, I mean, yeah, I think it's kind of cynical, but I think that's the point. This movie is narrated by him. We're seeing this, the entire plot of the movie, such as there is, play out from his point of view. So I wouldn't be, you know, I'm not surprised that it's cynical.
Well, no, it's just like, I don't know. It's not saying it's a fault. It's just, I don't know. It's like projecting too much on everyone else's faults, because you don't really ever see healthy relationships anywhere in here.
Well, you also have to wonder, how much of this is like, you know, you may have a little bit of unreliable narrator syndrome in this, only because, you know, skipping ahead to the end, when he writes a play about his and Annie's relationship, he changes the ending. So, you know, you have to also wonder how much of this is filtered.
Oh, well, that's interesting. You know me, Matt. I always love to go down that rabbit hole. I don't think it is.
Maybe it's not. I'm just saying that they introduced that possibility with this idea of, A, he's narrating, B, he's also trying to be this playwright, and C, he changes the narrative to fit his desired outcome.
Well, there's layers to it, right? So the fact that he shows you and owns up to writing the play that's the retelling of his relationship with her in the movie, he owns up to, like, what do you want? I wanted to have a happy ending. Because in that, the fake Woody Allen, Diane, get together at the end. In the real life, it doesn't. But I think in however this is framed, it's Elvie Singer explaining to the universe what this relationship was.
Right.
But when he is framing that, you see scenes like immediately, like where Diane Keaton's, he kind of pushes her, nags her into going back to adult education, continuing some, you know, coursework. He's like, oh, you know, the such interesting professors, you'll get to know them. And then smash cut to him getting jealous and talking about how stupid professors are. So the narrative is he's not making himself look good through most of this.
No,
right? So,
he's not.
I'm interested to see what the rest of that play looked like, because what is he telling people in that world?
But he's also, there are certain scenes where he's interpreting, or we're seeing what's going on in scenes where he's not there. I mean, because there's a scene where you see it's a split screen between him and Diane Keaton in their individual therapy sessions. And I mean, if the movie is being told from his point of view, how does he know what Diane Keaton is talking about in her therapy sessions?
For what it's worth, that's not a split screen. That was practical.
But you know what I mean.
IMDb trivia.
It's done in the split screen format, kind of, where you see them side by side.
Well, I mean, there's no defined structure to this. It's almost like omniscient, godlike perspective, but Woody Allen's the god in this thing. So presumably it's like, well, it's played as a great joke also, by the way, that he's like, I never have sex with her. And she goes,
we have sex all the time.
It's just constant. And they both say it's three times a week, which, you know, good stuff, right? Yeah. But I don't know. You can't define how the narrative structure
is. By the way, this theory that I have, I'm not saying that I necessarily buy into it. I just thought it was something interesting to think about, given how this film is narratively told.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But I think he's laying it all out there to whatever the audience is in this universe, or however he's speaking to it. I think he's looking back and like kind of reflecting on, you know, I don't know if he can realize, even after 15 years of therapy, the character in there, I don't know if he can really still see it, but he's just kind of laying it all out there,
yeah,
and letting it be impartially kind of judged. and anybody would see he was kind of nuts, but it's hard to define what that relationship at any given point was, like how open it was. They're openly flirting with other people at points. It's hard to kind of put your finger on where they were really at any given point, or how long their relationship was. Was it actually even called out?
I don't know, but we see them at their ups and downs. And when I say ups and downs, I mean, they break up and get back together at least a couple times within the course of the film.
So, year? I don't know. Yeah, I mean, it's tough. They intentionally don't give you any of that, really.
I don't know, but I mean, there are certain things that happen that make me think it goes on for a while. Namely, you know, we didn't really talk about it, but the first scene where it's supposed to be how Alvy and Annie meet. They meet over playing tennis with a couple of friends, a doubles match, and they just kind of start talking and hit it off. The reason I think enough time's passed is because, you know, even though there's not necessarily a plot to this movie, and Diane Keaton herself, her character goes through an arc, and you could see it throughout the film, because when she first meets him, she's very mm-hmm. shy, she's kind of naive, she's mumbling, and I love the scene too where they're talking to each other and it has the subtitles of what they're actually thinking. I thought that was mm-hmm. funny. But she goes from that to, like, within the course of the movie, being more assertive, standing up for herself, going toe to toe with him during these, you know, argument sessions. And ultimately, I mean, she's the one who turns him down at the end. So, I mean, it's enough for that sort of confidence to be built up in that character.
She ends up back in, so we're jumping all over the place.
Well, because this movie does too. Yeah. It's not told yeah. linearly. We jump in several points in their relationship.
And really the movie comes off as a almost a collection of sketches isn't
vignettes.
Right. Vignettes, yeah, comedic vignettes. And I was struck, like, I never made the connection before, but there were some flat out Marx Brothers jokes all through this.
Oh, yeah.
Of how he spoke an exact kind of like turn of phrases of Groucho. Like, he was Groucho-ing all over this film. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, does she end up having a career out there as a singer? And because she comes back to New York, but did we end up catching, like, what she actually did?
Well, doesn't she go off with, individual? Isn't that, first of all, I mean, cameos galore, but doesn't she end up going off with, isn't that Paul Simon?
Oh, yeah, 100%, yeah. Little itty-bitty Paul Simon.
I mean, I think the implication is she goes out to have a career with him as a producer or something.
I took that, so she ended up having, like, lounge singer type of notoriety, or kind of got noticed by Paul Simon, who is not playing Paul Simon in it. Tony Lacey is his character. He ends up convincing them to go out there to LA, and she ostensibly kind of, like, maybe for her career, we don't know. That is kind of a thread. I, you know, unless I zoned out, like, well, we lost the thread on what she ended up doing, but she was there for singing, like,
yeah, but I think
she ended up living with him.
No, that's the thing, is I think she stays and she ends up doing something with him, because, I mean, when they reconnect at the, you know, the California, I guess, vegan health restaurant, she mentions him and that they're doing well.
Oh, I took that as they're romantically entangled.
Well, I took that as both. Like that.
Well, probably, sure, yeah. So
yeah, she's enough. She's happy enough and content enough and assertive enough where, you know, at that point when Woody Allen tells her to go back with him, she assertively says, "No, I'm happy here."
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the first parts of the movie is they explain that they broke up, right? So it's not subversive or anything like that, but it is interesting that it isn't that traditional happy ending,
right?
It's also funny because it's probably on the shorter end of a relationship. how many other romantic comedies or romantic whatever films is it where it's not your first marriage, it wasn't his second, it's a one, I don't know, 9 month relationship that you had with somebody,
right?
Because they meet in the summer with lobsters and you see at Christmas, so 6 to 9 months, year, something like that, relationship, and then they don't get back together and they just move on. It is really odd that the more you think of it, it's very surprising that that's the structure of this. It's just one of the things along the way in your life, right? But I don't know. Where are my notes? I have just a collection of just oddball notes because it's just kind of all over the place.
It's an oddball movie. But, you know, one of the motifs I like is just his disdain for Los Angeles culture, to the point where, like, Woody Allen, as the writer and director of this film, is having people, you know, you overhear the conversations that the LA people are having, and it's just this ridiculous, you know, existential, artsy, hippie dialogue, to the point where you have Jeff Goldblum in a cameo, yeah, on the phone saying he forgot his mantra.
I don't think I ever got that joke until rewatching this a couple days ago. I'm always more blindsided that it's Jeff Goldblum than anything else. So that's the big one, like the Christopher Walken's the other major. I don't know if are cameos, though, are they? Because, like, well, this is old.
Well, like I said, it's not necessarily, like, it's cameos to us now, but I'm saying, you know, the game is spot the future movie star. I mean, because Christopher Walken is in this, and he plays kind of a very strange character, even stranger than his cameo in Pulp Fiction, I would say. It's
Christopher Walken, man.
But he's Annie's brother, and he dreams of sometimes driving headfirst into another car and just committing suicide.
Well, it's a funnier joke than that, because he's Woody's visiting the family wherever it is, Midwest somewhere, right? And he's just walking through the house, and he walks in on very much adult Christopher Walken still living at home, and he's like, "This is my room," and there's like nudie mags on the outside of the door, like facing out to where the parents would be, and he's just sitting there quietly, not doing anything, just kind of staring at the wall. Alan comes in, and then he relays that story to him, and then basically smash cut to Christopher Walken's driving them to the airport.
I know, and night, just watching, right, Woody Allen's facial expressions the whole time that he's driving, right, is hilarious.
Christopher Walken's also name is misspelled in the credits. So he's credited as Christopher W-L-A-K-N. So for what it's worth. Who else was in here? John Shelley Glover Duvall is in it. Shelley Duvall, John Glover, you know, Donald Trump from Gremlins 2 fame, basically.
But he was so much more charming than Donald Trump is in Gremlins 2.
Oh, he's what Donald Trump wishes he could be. Paul Simon, Sigourney Weaver is the one didn't say it at the beginning.
Is the one at the end. And unless you know that it's her, you could never tell, because it's not even a close-up. It's from far away.
No, right.
But it's funny because Sigourney Weaver, you know, for fans of her, she's a very tall woman. And so she's just towering over Woody Allen, even from far away.
Oh, I mean, that's why Paul Simon's in this, is because it gives somebody for Woody to be taller than. Also, bizarre bit of trivia. I looked this up. Paul Simon's character's girlfriend in this in L.A. was actually Garfunkel's real life girlfriend.
Oh, no way.
Who killed herself while with Garfunkel, like, a year after the filming of this, God, something like this. Cause I looked at, I'm like, okay, so this is the really bad thing, Matt. This is the really bad thing that took me out. I'm like, oh, she looks really young. Woody, what are you doing? And I looked her up to make sure she wasn't 17 at the time of the filming of this or something. And she was like 24, but she looked really young. And then I went down that biography thing of like Garfunkel, like, no, wait, Simon. And it was really confusing for a few seconds before I looked that up. I forget her name, but it's like Bird or something like that. She's in like three movies and then killed herself very young. So there you go. Downer. Geez, what else? I don't know. This is just such a tough one to kind of cover.
To do narratively, but the thing I do want to highlight is just the fact that, you know, of all the Oscars that this movie won, I really do feel that Diane Keaton deserved hers. I really like her in this film.
So, yeah, she's the, I don't know if it's breakout, but like, oh my, like, there is something really there. That's such a interesting character that changed, ditzy, bubbly, something like that, to having her own agency by the end of it, kind of. Yeah. But not to say that she didn't before. Like, she had like interesting photography and stuff.
No, she just became more sure of herself and a little bit more grounded.
So it's like, I don't know if she was ever like, Alan's character, again, I don't know how much he ever really said it, but he definitely made her feel it, like, not smart. That photography and what she was doing, it was fine. I think she's perfectly normal when she had to put on almost like the fake poser intellectualism that I always really hate, right? That's when it starts falling apart, because she can't just fake it like that and put on that, what, cover up the original sin, right, of being from, you know, Des Moines or wherever it ended up being, right? So,
you know, and he tries to make her cynical real fast. Just, you know, it, again, you know, one of those darkly funny things, the first things he gets are books about death.
Mm-hmm. Oh, one other cameo, Truman Capote, apparently.
Oh, yeah, the actual winner of the Truman Capote lookalike contest was Truman.
Evidently, Capote. It was Truman Capote. Yeah, so was that Dick Cavett also, by the way? Or was it like a Dick Cavett-like show? I can't picture it in my mind's eye now.
I don't know. I'm not sure.
Jeez. A lot of talk about psychoanalysis, like, you know,
a lot of talk about psychoanalysis. I think this must be the first time that that shrinks are, you know, mentioned throughout a film.
Also, it's like, it always threw me off as a kid calling it analysis. Nobody says that anymore. It's like, that, man, does that date it to the 70s,
as well as calling thing,
as well as calling pot grass.
Yeah,
grass. I did have that as a stupid note of like, wow, you want a data film, call it grass at points in there. Most iconic part of the movie is maybe the sneezing into the Coke.
Right? I mean, yeah, that was good. That was good.
I mean, I don't want to just get into the habit of like, you know, referencing all the funny individual scenes in here, but the movie really is that, but also really smart throughout and has the Jewish motif, the intellectual motif, intellectual stuff. What did I say? I don't know. It's just
cultural motif. It's odd.
Yeah, it's kind of all over the place. Covers a lot of ground. Nothing. I don't know. Jeez, I didn't. Oh, by the way, I didn't mention like what the other nominees for Best Picture were. I should bring that up because I'm actually curious about that, because this is like really good. However, I'm not entirely sure was this like Best Picture type stuff, because the Academy Awards gets it wrong so often. Turning Point, Star Wars, Julia, The Goodbye Girl, and Annie Hall. Of those, yes, I think this one probably was the Best Picture.
Yeah.
Close Encounters was nominated for Best Director with Steven Spielberg.
But it wasn't Best Picture, huh? Interesting.
Yeah. I don't know. That's surprising.
That one seems really like it would be more of a Best Picture thing than the Academy would be for Star Wars. But
well, you know, I think the Academy does feel a certain obligation when it's not like obviously a bad film to nominate, right? The box office stuff. I mean, even I'm looking at this now, I had no idea that Alec Guinness had a nomination for Best Supporting Actor as Obi-Wan.
I didn't know that either.
That, wow, that's news to me. Okay. I mean, considering how resentful he always seemed to be of that role.
I know, right?
It's like, dude, it got you an Academy Award nomination at least. So, all right. Well, man, I mean, where else do we want to go on this? Because it's a brisk movie, too.
It is. It's like a down 30 minutes, right?
Yeah, I mean, it gets in there, drops just tons of comedy, not a ton of plot, and I think we kind of hit on practically every beat, more or less, of the film. So, I don't know. Do we want to, like, tie this one off?
Yeah, we should.
All right. Well, Matt, go ahead. Where do you think does this stand the test of time? Should it be on the top of Alan's filmography?
I mean, having not seen a whole lot of Alan films, I don't know. But do I think it stands the test of time? It's very 70s. But like I said, there's a realness that I think is timeless. And I kind of appreciate the nonlinear structure of this. And yes, it's a cynical film, but it's told by a cynical guy. And it feels like it's not, cynicism is not played up for movie effect. It feels, again, the word I keep coming back to is real. And it's a very generic term, but I just appreciated the genuineness of this film. So I definitely recommend it. I enjoyed watching it, and Diane Keaton's just great. She earned that Oscar for me.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, she's the standout from this. Oh boy, did I think Paul Simon's acting was terrible in this, by the way.
He doesn't have a lot of lines, but yeah.
No, yeah, nothing but like, oof, dude, like maybe we need to cut down on that. Yeah, right. So I do have that weird curiosity of like, evidently Alan filmed a lot more of this movie and a lot more of the fantasy elements to it and asides, because there is one animated sequence in this, right, where he's like, it's like Snow White type of Disney animation. But apparently there were scenes like him playing basketball at like Madison Square Garden and a whole bunch of other things. Like, very bizarre alternate movie to this, but hey, film a ton and cut it down to, you know, 90 minutes, if that. And when there's no plot, you just cut all the dead weight and you get down to something pretty lean. But I would like to see what the alternate versions of this movie were. Because they ended up finding something. Like, I don't know if that was the editing. Like, why didn't this win best editing, by the way, either? Maybe it did. I didn't pull that up, actually, now that I mentioned that. But they found such a really interesting film. It's a real shame that Woody Allen's a piece of shit, probably. But it's not like Manhattan, where that element is pervasive throughout the movie. There's a couple jokes at the beginning, which you can look past, is just whatever. It does have that little stinger thing at the end, but other than that, it's a good film. It definitely deserves a bit of its reputation. I was surprised how much it's Marx Brothers, Groucho all through this. I guess I need to go back and watch like Sleeper and Bananas and other old Woody Allen things and just see how much that was all through there. Cause it's been a long time since I watched those goofier, films. I always love Sleeper, right? For instance.
I want to go back
and watch some of those.
I forgot to mention one other thing I found interesting about this film, except for the stuff that goes on in the background and Annie singing, there's no score.
Oh, guess so, right? Yeah. I mean, very kind of naturalistic choice, but I like with it. This. Well, I mean, I think if you had that in there, you'd have a complete, it would lead you too much.
Right.
Right. And hold your hand on the emotion, right?
I think it would feel a little too Hollywood. I think that adds to the realness of it, like I said.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, I mean, for film history and a turning point in Allen's career, because it was, this is where he got a bit more serious. So there's obviously a lot of like silly stuff too, but you know, What's Up Tiger Lily and stuff. It's hard to see that that's the same person that went to this. And then the dude up until maybe last year, where maybe it was a bridge too far, the dude was still pumping out a film a year like clockwork.
Yeah.
You know, just constantly. I think the, what was the last one that you saw? I think my last one was Match Point in like 2007, maybe something like that.
The last one like that one I was new that ones. The last one that I actively remember, and I can't remember the name of it, but it was the one with Emma Stone and someone else, like Magic in Paris or something like that.
Well, now the actors get so much flack for being in his movies that they back out by cancel culture. So yeah, I don't know. He might be kind of at the end, but he has a lot of secret French movies or movies set in France and that kind of stuff. So, all right.
Well, I forgot about, Blue Jasmine. That got Cate Blanchett the Oscar. That was the last one that I remember.
Oh yeah. I haven't seen that one. Right. A lot of secret films. All right. Well, you know, there you go. I mean, Annie Hall, weird movie to be able to talk and have a coherent train of thought on. Just a lot of good mishmash all in there in a blender, more or less, right?
Yeah.
All right. Well, my turn now. And we set our sights to May. And boy, we can keep the weird Jewish hypochondriac story thread going. Because the random number generator picked one of my options as Portnoy's Complaint from 1972, predating this, by the way, starring the disgusting Richard Benjamin. A little bit, again, editorializing. But during a session with his psychoanalyst, Alexander Portnoy rants about everything that is bothering him, and it's a long list. His complaints include his childhood, his family, with an emphasis on his mother, his sexual fantasies, and the problems that he has with women.
I mean, that sounds like the movie we just watched.
And his obsessive feelings about Judaism.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the movie we just watched, but apparently horrendous. And I just like TCM calls it the genre adaptation because it's adopted from a book. So I look because I start when I research these, I'm not picking this film. I read about it and apparently it is 101 minutes of just offensive Jew jokes. It's supposed to be really bad. So it's like, wow, TCM, bold choice. This is a 4:30 a.m. movie. Again, my theorem about what that can bring you to. So strike that one from the list, Matt. And also, I just think Richard Benjamin is grotesque. I don't know why, but I've always hated him in everything.
So I take it you're not,
anyhow.
Take it you're not a big no. West Side Story person then.
Well, no, actually, no, not so much. Next up, 1981's Blind Chance. A young man suddenly quits medical school, catches a train out of town, and eventually becomes a leading light in a communist youth group. Or he misses the train and finds God plus the love of a complicated Jewish woman. There's a strong theme here. Don't read into it. The act of catching the missing train and planes carries our hero into possible futures in this probe. And then the rest is cut off.
But it has something to do with communism. And like, this is the one where I'm like, he's going to make me watch another Russian themed film. We already had two.
Dare you? It's Polish. And of note, this is the movie that Sliding Doors shamelessly ripped off. By the way, it's not the original, and that's a remake. They just ripped it. So just there you go. Next, from 1963, Tom Jones. In 18th century England, an abandoned orphan is adopted by a squire. The young Tom Jones grows up to become a bawdy womanizer.
Starring Daddy Warbucks and Superman's mom.
Yeah, a man is a young Albert Finney challenging. I'll say it's odd because I just like his gaping mouth as an old man's the only thing I can kind of picture. I'm such a catty bitch, but it's just what it is.
What else is new?
I know. From 1991, The Fisher King. A former radio DJ, suicidally despondent, becomes a terrible mistake. Because of a terrible mistake he made, finds redemption in helping a deranged homeless man who was an unwitting victim of that mistake. Excuse me, I kind of stumbled through that one. But starring Jeff Bridges and Robin Williams. And then finally, from 1984, The Muppets Take Manhattan. It's kind of goofy that I'm going to read anything on this, but Broadway bound, The Muppets Take Manhattan by storm in the magical musical about breaking into show business, et cetera, et cetera. It's a Muppets film.
So first of all, let me just say that I have a sinking feeling I'm going to be suckered into watching more Eastern European bullshit, but
why? What on earth would make you think that?
But because you're just that kind of depressing, cynical person. But I gotta say, if for nothing else, Matt, we've had this discussion of we've never done these musicals, and we've had options. We've had Ziegfeld Follies.
You're right.
We've had Ziegfeld Follies. We've had like Cabaret. We've had certain options. I think it would be absolutely goddamn hilarious if the first musical we ever did for this show was The Muppets Take Manhattan. I think that it would be fucking hilarious. And I would love to watch Muppets Take Manhattan. I would also like to watch The Fisher King. I have a feeling I'm watching more Eastern European bullshit though. But I just gotta throw that out there that I think it would suit both of our senses of humor if our first musical ever was a Muppets film.
So I'll walk you through. So again, Portnoy's complaint was like, if it wasn't for Richard Benjamin, I'm like, oh, we're going to watch this trash. But that's the bridge too far. So I struck that one from the list. I will say I was never going to touch Blind Chance. That's the Polish alternate, you know, what if life movie. I did look at the trailer. It has like a interesting like, oh, this is just different because it's an 80s Polish Behind the Iron Curtain movie. So it has just like an odd vibe to it that I'd be interested in. But then I look at that runtime and I'm like, I'm not that interested in it. So I'm going to strike that one from the list. Like I said, young Albert Finney is off-putting. I don't know if I could do that. And that's an hour 31.
If you're making points about the runtimes, may I just point out that The Muppets Take Manhattan is a cool 94 minutes?
I see that. I'm just going through some individual logics. 131 minutes for young Albert Finney. And excuse me, I am profoundly uninterested in that one. So it comes down to The Fisher King and The Muppets movie. The Muppets Take Manhattan, because The Muppets movie is something else. Here's the deal. We just went through just such a weird comedy that was really like good, but kind of tough to watch and analyze or tough to dissect and talk about. I do have worries that I'm going to like struggle talking about Kermit's motivation.
I've seen The Muppets Take Manhattan.
What makes Fozzie tick?
There are more arcs in that film than you realize. I'm just saying.
I am sure. However, one of my favorite filmmakers of all time
is Gilliam.
Is the chaotic disaster of a human being that is Terry Gilliam. And it's Robin Williams. And this has been on my Letterboxd to watch rewatch list for a long time. And if I recall, if nothing else, Terry Gilliam gives you shit to talk about. And it's usually like really flawed, but awesome in other areas.
I can't necessarily be mad at this also too, because I heard actually when Robin Williams passed away, I heard this film come up more than once as one of his good ones. So I'm not that upset.
Oh yeah, no. So yes, it is Fisher King, because it's that thing where it's the Terry Gilliam. It's, man, does that dude swing for the fences? And it can be Brazil, and I argue the Adventures of Baron Munchausen is awesome. Or you can have all the movie sets burned down and the movie doesn't exist. You know, you get basically that, and it's all or nothing with him. And every actor hates him afterwards just because he's so insane. So I want to talk about that. But yes, Matt, you're right. It does have a 137 minute runtime, which is a cost of doing business here.
I'm not mad, because that's the other one I would have been fine watching. I'm just happy I'm not watching the Polish film.
Yeah, me too. I mean, listen, it was Stalker, man. It's one of the greatest science fiction films of all time.
In which nothing happens for 3 hours.
You're completely correct. You're 100% on point with that. That said, there's good stuff in there. You just have to be kind of led to it. So, all right, there you go. What a chaotic little episode we had here, but I had fun, and it was fun. I haven't watched a Woody Allen flick in a long time, but it makes me want to go back and watch Sleeper, which, by the way, Austin Powers, like 1000% ripped off as well. Go have a look at that, but please continue the conversation over online. Like, what did we miss in Annie Hall? I'm sure there's a ton. But let us know over at tcmchallenge@gmail.com. More than happy to continue the conversation there. We can be found on Facebook on TCM Challenge. I need to get better about updating that, but still see a little trickle in there. And by the way, still get those weird influxes into the UP2 Facebook page. Somebody drops that podcast somewhere else and it causes a weird little influx. So, by the way, go back and check out our Star Trek podcast that went on for years, Upper Pylon 2. I can be found online at Goodreads if you want my book stuff. And then Letterboxd as Pro Sub Zero. Yeah. It's the best social media thing out there. It's funny.
And you can not go grotesque. You can go read how much Matt is a snarky bitch when he talks about movies.
That's not true. I watch a lot of good stuff on there. Thief. I just watched Thief. Michael Mann. My review is, why can't every movie be a 1980s Michael Mann movie? Awesome.
See, you can hear the bitchy
beacon of positivity.
You can hear the bitchy snarkiness directed toward other movies in just that one sentence.
All right, touche. Matt, where can we find you not being a bitch all the time?
Oh, I never said that.
I know.
I own the fact that I'm a bitch. And you can see me being a bitch on Twitter at mhansen0207, H-A-N-S-E-N, you know, talking movies, politics. Talk to me this week. I'm going to go on Friday on Alien Day to see the 45th anniversary re-release of the original.
Ooh.
So talk to me about the Alien series. And are you excited for Alien Romulus? Because I sure am after that trailer.
We've talked extensively about that. Yes. Very cautiously, very optimistic. You know, please be good. And just like a balls to the wall, good old horror movie, right?
I mean, I'm excited. Just that 90 seconds got me really excited.
If we can get out of that movie without 20 minutes of just two androids
fingering each other.
Yes. Blowing each other's flute. I think I'll take that as a win.
Yeah.
Right. So,
I mean, hell, they're saying all the right things, including the fact that apparently the aliens are going to be back to people in suits and not the CGI bullshit that we've been getting.
How hard is it? Right. Put the guy in a suit, put him in a shadow and just goop him up, get him real wet. And that's all I need from.
I mean, could this be the first good Alien movie since 1986? We shall see.
Yes, I don't know. I am a big defender of Alien Cubed.
You would be wrong.
Nonsense! It's a masterpiece. Depending on the cut,
piece of garbage.
Oh, Matt and I are going to fight for an hour after the recording stops now. So with that, we'll tune in next month with The Fisher King. I'm legit really looking forward to this one. So yeah. All right. And with that, I am Matt in Buffalo.
And I'm Matt in Arizona. Thank you so much for joining us on this month's edition of the TCM Challenge. And as Balzac said, there goes another novel.